welcoming Jonathan Doyle to be speaking to us later on. And just before we start, I've got some housekeeping things, and then we'll open with a prayer, and then we'll go off. Okay. So my name is Christina Biggs. I'm the organiser. We've had three sessions already. So this is the third session. So we started off with Andrew Hellstrap in the autumn, and then we had Ernest Lucas in the spring. And this is the third. So to start off with then, fire escape is through there. So the door there, if you open it, the door at the other end will open automatically, in theory. And you go through that door and down the spiral staircase and out. That's the fire escape. Ernest talked, Roger Tucker, aren't you? Lovely. Has made a recording which is available on the internet in a very special format, which is very, I've tried it myself, and it's very much worth it. What he's done is if you go to the website, you have to download the particular application, and once it's done that, it's got the slides there, it's got the text, you know, lots of the text, and it's got the audio kind of nicely packaged up. So I do recommend that, and I'll be emailing you all the details if you want to get on the mailing list. Failing that, if you'd like, you can request them tonight, and you can run off CDs if you want an audio CD of last talk. That will happen for this talk. We'll be having a similar recording online for this talk available shortly after. Now the next talk, if you look at the leaflets that we've got here, the blue leaflets, it's going to be on Cynthia, which is the new synthetic molecule that has just been created, a new synthetic cell that's just been claimed to have been created. And so John Bryant, who's a professor at Exeter University, is going to talk about that. And it's the 19th of November. Now on the fly you'll see it says going to be confirmed. Well, I'm happy to say that we managed to negotiate it with this room again. So if you take it away and wonder what venue it is, it's this venue, and I will email you with that. To that end, Father Hoyle, who's the parish priest here, has written an article about Cynthia. Which, if you pay 50p, you can take away the parish magazine and read the article.
There's such thing as a free lunch, you know.
And to take away, and I've got them up here, if you'd like to take it away and read up what Father Hall's got to say about Cynthia and its sort of theological implications. I think that's it from that. The nations. Now, this time I've taken to actually asking for donations of £2. Now I just want to explain where that figure comes from. This room costs £75 each time, and Christians and Science National very kindly paid for that for the last two sessions, but they won't do so again, so if you start up, we've had that. So that's why I'm asking for suggested donation £2 each, and that's going to be ongoing, because that will raise approximately £150 if everyone here, if it's I think about 75 here, and that will be enough to cover the speaker costs as well, and the travel and the room and the photocopying as well. Mailing list, there's a clipboard there if you'd like to put your names on the mailing list if you're not already on it, and then you'll get notification about future events. Okay, and finally about Jonathan Doyle. We've got off-prints of the paper that we wrote together. Fortunately, I rather actually put them out at the back, and they were supposed to be sold, but it doesn't matter, that's fine. So if you feel moved, you can put something in the basket for them. I've got two left over here. And if you'd like to, put your name on the mailing list and I can send you the copy of the of the paper, if you like. That's the paper that Jonathan and I wrote together about this particular topic. Sensei John. So Jonathan Doy, university lecturer in theoretical chemistry. His speciality is computer modelling of DNA motors. That's his exchange of the supper. You have these strands of DNA, and they actually sort of get these things that walk along them, so molecular scale squawks, robots, and he models them. That's pretty fascinating. His son wrote a nice poem about him, in which he describes that he combs his hair with a giant's chair. He cleans his teeth with a piece of beef. He takes a shower to give him power. But before I invite the point about inviting Jonathan was that back in 1994, Jonathan was lead author of a paper on chance provenance and free will, and I was in the group that wrote it with him. So that's how I know him. But before we start, could the Father Pistorius please come and give us a prayer? This is how.
Let us pray. Eternal God, creator of the universe, too wonderful for us ever fully to understand, look kindly upon us this evening as we ponder the mysteries of your divine providence and our human free will. We ask this in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Hey, thank you very much, Dina. Great to see so many people coming along. I hope find what I have to say interesting. Just sort of a couple of things to want to say before I kind of start thinking about these kind of issues. As Tina's hinted at, my thinking on these issues started when we were graduate students together. We formed a local Christian science group. We had meetings like this. We also got a smaller group together to sort of produce a paper for one of the Christian science conferences. And this sort of what came out of that, and then we got published in Science as Christian Belief. But it's something that's might be worth some of you thinking about. There's lots of people here. If you want to start thinking about a particular issue, that's a kind of good forum, way to do it, and you can present your results at a conference and kind of get feedback on them. What I want to talk about tonight is those kind of issues of chance, providence, and free will. Whether in a modern scientific age, it's still does science and disallow us from talking about God's action in the world, or what limits does science place on that, and think about some of the questions what sort of philosophical questions we might ask about free will, how our mind works, how might influence our theology. So here's a couple of kind of objections to a view that God can act in the world. This is quite older one. This guy Jack Monod. He was, I think, he won the Nobel Prize. He was one of the founding fathers of molecular biology. He's a Frenchman, and he said things in a particular strident way. So he says, think about evolution and what that meant for him in terms of a belief in a god or anything or in religion. He said, pure chance, absolutely free but blind, is at the very root of the stupendous edifice of evolution. So he's a proponent of evolution, but also for what it meant for philosophically. They're actually telling us that chance is at the heart of evolution, tells him that, in some sense, evolution is purposeless. And so he goes on elsewhere in his book, with the book Chance and Necessity. The ancient covenant is in pieces. Man, at last, knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he only emerged by chance. That's really strident sort of quotes. But for him, he sees chance and the role of chance in biology as telling him the world is purposeless. And you can probably find some fairly similar quotes for some like Richard Dawkins from a more modern context. So, yeah, these are quite old quotes. Richard Dawkins getting enough publicity, so I thought I'd put some quotes from somebody else who's equally strident. Here's kind of another objection to the way you might think about God working in the world. And this is an older one, and the idea of can we still think about the possibility of miracles happening in the past or happening today? Is that a reasonable notion, given what we know about science? And so this is a philosophical objection from David Hume, a little while ago. And he says, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle, from the very nature of the fact, is as entire as any argument for experience can possibly be imagined. So what he's saying is that natural laws, if he's going to believe anything, it's going to be natural laws. So if natural laws are true, then miracles can't be. That's kind of logic. So as a Christian, we might want a picture of God as providential God who's active in his creation. But is this compatible with what we learn about the physical world from science? And if, going on from that, if we still think it is, can we say anything? Can what we learn from science delimit anything we want to say about how God acts in the world? So where are we going to go in this talk? We're going to think a bit about chance, or think about some issues raised by Monod. Is chance really purposeless? Is it so blind? Does it mean the covenant is now in pieces? Think a bit about miracles. And then sort of think about how God's action and scientific law, are they kind of opposites, or might they be something that work together? So this is the kind of start. And the next kind of phase is thinking about how we might think about issues of human freedom, human action and free will, what's the kind of some of the philosophical questions there, and how that influences how we might then think about our theology. I'm going to sort of take two case studies of very kind of important people in Britain for think about the science of Christianity. Donald Mackay, who was very influential in probably the 70s and 80s, and John Polkinghorne in there sort of more recently, and how they answer questions about how they envisage the brain working and the mind working, about free will, how that influences their theology. I'll show you actually some of these kind of questions can be very important in terms of, they're not just totally either philosophical questions, but then can influence how we think about the world and how we think about God acting in that world. So when we talk about a chance event, what things do we mean by chance event? And you can perhaps break them down into certain types of events. So the first kind of event is what's sometimes called a chaotic event. It's say when you have events that are unpredictable because we can never possess sufficient knowledge of the initial conditions so we can really say what happens in the future. So one of the classic examples of this is kind of the weather. We might, if we could map out the kind of weather conditions, the atmospheric conditions at a certain point, how long in the future can we predict the weather for? And beyond a certain point, it becomes impossible to predict it in detail because you need to know the initial conditions so precisely that you've got sort of different futures which spread apart from each other. You also have kind of chance events. We have two effectively independent chains of events impinging on each other. So if you you could think about something like a meteor hitting the Earth. The link between those two events of what this meteor doing, what the trajectory of the Earth, so long ago, they're kind of two causally independent events. Could you also think about more kind of an example of that, more relevant to our lives, is we might get a mutation in one of our genes because there's a particular UV photon that hits our DNA, causes a mutation there, but the connection between where we were walking and where this photon happened to come across, they're so causally disconnected that this, you could say, it's a kind of chance event. And recently I nearly got hit by a falling branch from a tree, missed me by about 10 seconds, but what was causing that branch to fall down and where I was walking at the same time were totally independent events. And then you have events that might be kind of genuinely physically indeterminate, that we can't say they have no prior cause. And this, typically think about sort of quantum mechanical events. So it's not a lack of knowledge, but something that's unknowable in some sense. So in its conventional interpretation, whether a quantum event, if there's say half a probability of half doing one thing or half another thing, it cannot be determined which one it will do. But so you have these kind of chance events, but are chance events such a bad thing? I want to first think about how chance is kind of quite a pejorative word in some sense. And it has a kind of feeling of absence of purpose in it already. But is it so true that chance events are some things which can't have any direction? And I would say no, in one sense. So as a scientist, we often don't like the word chance. We substitute it by a fancy word. And so as a physicist, I have to talk about stochastic process. What I really mean by that is processes which have randomness in them. And this is an example of a kind of random process, which is totally random at one level, but we can still say some well-defined things about it. So this is a picture of Mr. Robert Brown. He looks rather grumpy. And he's famous for observing the random notion of a pollen particle in his microscope as it gets buffeted around by all the solvent molecules exerting force in it one direction, and sometimes they push it that way, and sometimes they push it that way. And so you have this what they call Brownian motion, this random motion of this particle in his microscope. He sort of, I think at first he wondered if this thing was alive, tried to kill it, and realised it was actually dead, and it wasn't propelling itself around, but it was just being pushed around by the kind of random forces that it was being subjected to through the fluid it was in. But we can say there's some well-defined physical laws describing Brownian motion, or what we call diffusive motion. If you have a bullet and it's travelling at constant velocity, the distance it travels is just proportional to the time taken if it's going at constant speed. But if you have this kind of Brownian motion, diffusive motion, you can actually prove that the average distance it travels is proportional to the square root of the time taken. But notice it's an average. So we can't say what will particularly happen, where this particular particle will be in the future time. We can say what will be if we observe lots of these things happening. We can say on average where they will be. So you can talk about chance processes, and they can be have all well-defined behaviour. So if you're a cell, so basically all kind of motion in a liquid like water is going to be stochastic. The motion of the particle is going to be chaotic. And so the environment our body works in, our cells work in, is an inherently kind of chance environment, stochastic environment. And one thing the body's got to do is trying to operate within that environment. And it can do because there can be well-defined properties of that environment. And chance processes can be also used to solve problems. So here's something that's kind of close to my heart. I do computer simulation, computer modelling, and I spend my life calculating random, or my computer spends its life calculating random numbers. And you think, why would you want to calculate random numbers? What impossible use can that be? If chance is just a kind of purposeless thing and it can't be used for any useful purpose. So this is an example of how you might calculate pi. This is not a good way of calculating pi. And so what you'd have, so this is a little bit of science in here. So you have a square and you have a circle inscribed within it, and you take out some darts, you start randomly throwing at your board. And hopefully these dots are spread randomly around the board. They're probably actually not, because I probably did it by eye and put some correlations in by accident. But what you can say is, okay, what's the probability that the dart will land within the circle? And so the probability is just the number of times I throw, or the number of times it lies in the circle divided by the number of throws. And that will be, over a sufficiently long time, or sufficient number of average over a sufficient number of goes, the area of the circle divided by the area of the square. If this is a length 2, the radius of this is 1, so the area of this is pi, and the area of the square is 4. So this average will end up as pi by 4. If I do it long enough time, I will get the answer for a number for pi. So I can solve a problem like that, and I spent most of my life actually solving more important, more interesting problems than this. I do Monte Carlo simulations. So my DNA, if I simulate my DNA motors, this is what I use, Monte Carlo. But we can actually use them to solve problems. So this is kind of a trivial problem. But, for example, I said cells work within this kind of environment where exactly some signaling molecule will be in the cell will be quite random, it will be fusing around. And they have to do work, perform computations, even despite that chance environment. and so they need to decide, do I need to turn this gene on or off in a cell, or something like that. And they have to do similar kind of computations using stochastic processes in some way. On a larger scale, evolution in some sense could be said to be an optimization problem. What you're trying to do, an organism is trying to improve its fitness, and where you have these stochastic processes operating, which would be some random changes to the genome, most of them will be deleterious, and they're acted on by natural selection, says this is a bad idea. But those which produce beneficial change, which makes the organism be a bacteria or whatever, which is evolving resistance to an antibiotic, but fitter, then they'll be selected by natural selection. So it's where chance can again be used to solve a problem. And there's kind of open questions about evolution. How contingent is the pathway of evolution? If we replayed the kind of history of the Earth, how different would it be? And some people actually saying actually evolution is somewhat constrained, it has direction. That evolution converges onto the same solutions to problems. The famous example of different eyes of different organisms. Our kind of camera eye in our species, and the eye is an octopus which has a similar kind of camera eye. So that's saying actually chance is not necessarily such a bad thing to have. It's not necessarily some purpose. But I think there's the kind of bigger kind of theological question, and whether we consider random events to be purposes or not is dependent on our kind of presuppositions. If I'm an atheistic scientist and I don't believe there's a God, then it's quite reasonable to believe a chance event has no purpose. If I'm a Christian and I might have certain beliefs associated with God, I might believe he was omnipotent or omniscient, there's no reason why such events shouldn't be within the orb of a providential God. So all those, whether I get hit by some UV light which causes a mutation in particular part of my DNA, which might then give me cancer, we could say, is that outside God's orb? If we believe certain things about God, I don't think we need to say it is. And this is kind of interesting quote from one of the writers of Proverbs, saying, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord, saying, actually have this chance events, but these biblical writers saying, actually, that's not something which is outside of God's knowledge. And so these kind of criticisms that come from Monod, I think reflect his presuppositions. He's an atheist, he didn't believe in God, and this was kind of confirmation for him. But whether we believe in a God, I think comes from elsewhere. And it's from these presuppositions that we can kind of view how we see chance. So I don't see these kind of chance, the role of chance in biology and in our life as any kind of threat to our theology necessarily, or to view God as being providential. So miracles. Are they scientifically disproven or philosophically disproven by kind of Hume? We can look at Hume's argument on a number of levels. Do we agree with his definition of what a miracle is? So he talked about that as a breaking of scientific law. Is that how we want to think about miracles that have happened? The Bible doesn't usually didn't necessarily have a concept of the scientific law, but usually talks about signs and wonders, events that are both kind of extraordinary and significant. And you can have certain types of miracles. So you can have sort of things which are deemed to be extraordinary, not because the individual events are extraordinary, but how they were coincident. So when Jesus calmed the storm, was the calming of the storm, the fact that the storm died down wasn't necessarily an unphysical event. Storms blow up and they die down. But what was the miraculous about it was that when Jesus said, it commanded the storm to calm down, that it did calm down. So you have this impinging of the two, this miracle of timing. And whether some physical law was broken in that miracle, who knows, but I don't think we necessarily need to say it was due to breaking of physical law. So this guy, Colin Humphreys, he's a professor of materials in Cambridge, and one of the things he's looked at is looking at some of the miracles in the Bible and saying, actually, can we think about them in terms of this kind of miracles of timing? So he's looked at things like the crossing of the Jordan, and looked in. It's quite interesting if you read the kind of the biblical narrative there, and it talks about the water being piled up at a particular place, not where they're crossing, but further up. And he seems to find there's actually evidence that this is a particular place which was liable for have landslides, which would then potentially block the Jordan in that region, and then that would prevent the water flowing downstream for a certain time. And these kind of events could be recorded. So for him, he sees that as a possibility of how this particular miracle could have happened. But it's a miracle because of its timing. They were able to cross the Jordan when Joshua put his sort of led the Israel across. But so some might not involve any breaking of physical law, but that's not why that's not the essential aspect of the miracle. And it would in some sense show God's control over natural events. But for other miracles we read about in the Bible, it's hard to see how they would occur without some physical law being broken, that e.g. the resurrection. But if these physical law, so we have a miracle which presumably did break some physical law. How we interpret that, again, depends on our presuppositions. And if the physical law and the scientific laws, the physical world and the scientific laws that follow from that are kind of our basic reality, we don't believe a reality beyond the world we can see, then that might be a reasonable presupposition to say, actually, why on earth would the physical laws be broken? We see that they're never, when we haven't observed them in the laboratory, we never see them be broken. Why should they be broken at a particular time? But if our basic reality is God and the scientific laws are then some reflection of his character and the way he wants to act in the world and the way he's choosing to order the world, then I don't see any reason why he cannot choose to break those laws. So again, it comes back to what our presuppositions and what our basic beliefs are. And so I don't think that's these kind of arguments are any threat to Christianity. So, just to kind of look at some of the things that we can find in the Bible about saying about how God's providence. So I have one from Hebrews here, which talks about God sustaining all things. So I have the idea of God as a sustainer. And again from Colossians, God holds things all together. So you do see a picture of God as being kind of continually involved and caring for creation. This is quite a nice little kind of quote from Psalms. It says, God makes springs pour water into the ravines. So it's the theme of God being behind this process of water flowing and production of water. But then it says, the water flows between the mountains, but it flows by its own nature as well. So you see kind of switching perspectives from God being behind something and something doing something because of its own natural properties. So you see these juxtaposed, they're not necessarily contradictory views of God being behind something and something happening due to scientific sort of natural law, but that the regular behaviour of natural phenomenon does, in some sense, reflect God's providential sustaining of the world. But I think when we think about God's providence, there are a couple of things we should kind of be aware of, or kind of, I think one is, which is generally sort of unpopular, is some kind of deistic notion that God started out the world and left it to run on its own, it's kind of completely independently. But I think most people like to think of God actually continuously caring for his creation. And so I don't think there's any reason to reject that from a scientific perspective. Another more kind of relevant idea is, which is kind of lampooned as called by the kind of phrase God of the gaps, is that seeing God acting in the places where we might see that scientific explanations can't or are struggling to provide an explanation. And this is kind of particularly relevant to the debate about intelligent design. The intelligent design argument is, in fact, effectively that certain biological structures couldn't have come about by evolution. They're so inherently unlikely to have come about. They've done their maths and they've decided that it's so unlikely that instead of evolution being behind it, God must have been behind it. I think that's kind of a mistake on both the scientific level and a kind of basic kind of theological level. I think it's nicely kind of signed up by this Charles Coulson, who was a professor of theoretical chemistry in Oxford, which is kind of one of my four bears in Oxford in theoretical chemistry. When we come to scientifically known, our correct policy is not to rejoice because we have found God, it's to become better scientists. And this kind of reflects back, if we see God as being in the gaps of where we can't explain, or is God behind natural law, and that natural law reflection of what God does in the world. So I think it's the intelligent design kind of arguments are a scientific mistake as well. I won't go into that. So this is a nice quote from Augustine. He says, "Nature is what God does. We shouldn't think of what happens in the natural world as being something that's left to go apart from God, but that reflects who God is and how he wants to work in the world." But now sort of moving on to think about some more kind of difficult and thorny questions. How should we think about human freedom and how that impinges on God's action in the world or God's sovereignty? So this is Pascal Don Carson, a US theologian, has tried to look at the tension between God's sovereignty and human freedom, and this is his kind of conclusion. You may or may not agree with that, but just I'll put that up as a kind of example of how he has thought about what the Bible says about this. So he sees God as being sovereign, but his sovereignty doesn't function to mitigate or curtail human freedom, responsibility. But at the same time as God being sovereign, human beings are morally responsible. They make significant decisions and choices to believe or defy, and are rightly held accountable for such actions. But that doesn't interfere with God's sovereignty or make him contingent. And you see this juxtaposition in certain kind of verses. It's quite a nice verse. "In his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines the steps." You have both God being behind something, but us being behind something. But the kind of question, how can these be hoped to be simultaneously true? Is this just kind of philosophical nonsense to try and hold them in tension, or hold aspects of God's sovereignty and human freedom in tension? Do we have to have one? Do we have to forgo something in the other? So to start kind of thinking about this, I think, and human freedom, I think it's important to think about how we perceive the mind to work, because that any free acts are going to be based on decisions of our mind. And there have been various classical positions, sort of classical ways of thinking about the mind-body problem, are sort of simplified into three kind of positions. So we have this first position, which was kind of probably the favourite pre-science, was kind of attached to the name of René Descartes in terms of Cartesian dualism. And it basically says the mind and brain are kind of different kinds of stuff. We have a brain, but our decisions are made by our mind, which is kind of independent of our brain. So the kind of caricature of this Cartesian dualism was that in your mind you have this little man, this homunculus, who gets fed information through the senses, but we have this kind of separate spirit, which is separate from our physical stuff, which can then make decisions. And so it's a decision-making ability, a freedom, in some senses, a property of some different stuff, which isn't physical. But that's generally been, in a kind of more scientific area, has generally been rejected, because we know how interdependent our brains and mind are, brains and mind, the brain and the level of the brain and the mental are so interlinked. If we go and get drunk and we do something to our body, something happens to our mind. And then you see that on a kind of a deeply neurological level as well. And the idea in to one of the ways of thinking about that is saying this, what they often call a dual aspect monism, has a lot of different labels. So what do they mean by that? There's one monism, there's one kind of stuff. There's just a physical brain, and without that, our mind wouldn't exist. But you can think about that one kind of stuff, and it has different aspects. And one aspect of that will be the purely material, another aspect will be the mind and the mental. And so you say the mind is embodied in the brain. Without the brain, there wouldn't be any mind. But that they have some kind of independence. I think a little bit more about how we might start to think about that. But the last kind of category would be kind of a more materialistic thing, which is saying actually the material is what the ultimate reality, and the mind and consciousness is just some kind of epiphenomenon, something we can feel but is not really the driver. The material is in control of what we do. But most Christians would, sort of Christian scientists would nowadays sort of take this kind of position. So one of the people we're going to look at a little bit more later, Donald Mackay, he was a neuroscientist, and he kind of, the way he thought about, started to think about this kind of approach, saying every aspect of our conscious experience has some correlate in some activity of our brain. So when we think something or decide something, something must change in our brain at the same time. Some correlated change. And no change can take place in our conscious experience without correlated change taking place in some neural subsystem. So you have these different levels which change simultaneously. It's not like one, he sees it's not one level pushing on the other, or the other level pushing on the up. And the way I like to kind of think it's quite helpful to think about how something can have two different levels is if you think about a computer, and you have the level of the material where you have your semiconductors and your electrons moving around. But if we run a program on the computer, what controls what the output of that program is? What controls it is how we've designed the program. If we've designed it correctly, it will produce the right output. It's not controlled by the material. It's not. It can't just get a different answer when we run it because the electrons and the semiconductors have decided to do something different. And it's because the computers has all the lower level of the physical material, it's organized in a certain way. You've got transistors which are wired up together, and et cetera, et cetera. And the bottom level, the material has been designed so that it performs a function at a higher level, the level of the program. I think in the same kind of way with our brain, just because we have this brain here, which is probably the most complex object in the universe. It has huge amount of structure in it. And it's that structure which allows it to have these different levels, where the level of the mind can then the level of the mind, you can have goals, you can have achieve certain things, and they'll be embodied in what happens in your neural circuitry. But your neural circuitry is not what's in charge. Can be the higher level, and the neurons and everything are the kind of workers of the mind. Okay, so free will. Here's a question for you. So this is kind of a question to hang, what I've used to try and hang how we might start to think about free will. And it's basically think about how is free will compatible with any kind of determinism. So I want you to think about this question. So suppose a person has made a choice between two possibilities. We call them X and Y. And they've chosen to do X for whatever reason. If the exact circumstances of that choice are repeated, and what we mean by the exact circumstances, the whole universe was the same, the person's brain was the same state, what would happen? You can kind of think of two possibilities. One, the person would always do the same thing. Let's say X, X being what the person wanted to do. Or you can think the other option would be actually person could do either, still have the ability to do either X or Y. What you're kind of saying, if you're saying this, is that actually your ability to choose has some kind of independence of what's previously happened in what's the state of the current state of that physical world at that time. Because if the current state is repeated, this was saying actually you can still do either of those. Whereas this would say actually we'd always do the same thing. So what you're kind of saying is freedom is the essence of freedom, the fact that it's not indeterminate, it's not controlled by determinism, or is the essence of freedom something else? And in this kind of this answer, you'd say actually, perhaps the essence of freedom is not that I have some kind of independence of the past, what's happened in the past, but that the important thing is that this choice X is what I wanted to do. And if we have, I think the way I read choose the mind brain problem before is how we think about the mind and the body, is if we take some kind of position like this, where the mind and the body are inextricably linked, what you're kind of saying is that we, well, the important thing is not that we have this, in choice, we have this total freedom from the past, but the choice is made by me. It's determined by me. And that being what I wanted to do. But this physical state, the previous physical state of the universe, including my brain, encompasses what I am thinking, what I am wanting, what I am feeling. Okay. So, when you, I'm just going to break for a minute or two, have a little think about that, and decide which you think of these answers to this question you think is most likely to be correct, or would you be most happy with? So the kind of problems for each one is this one really free enough that if we repeat the decision, we always do the same thing? Is that really what, can we still be free if we can't have this type of independence from the past? And the kind of problem with this is, if we have this total independence from the past, and that past includes the state of my mind, my brain, what's causing the choice? Is that I want this choice to be perhaps determined by me? But if I've got this total independence from the past, is that still, what's that choice attributable? So I'll give you a minute or two, and then we're going to poll on what people would think. Well, how people want to answer this question, and if people are brave enough to say why they want to answer in particular ways. So feel free to discuss between you. Just have a poll first. You can either choose you want or prefer to agree with that one, or to kind of abstain because you think it's a silly question.
Well, it's a question of preference, or what we think happens.
I'll let you decide. So let's say what we think might be most likely to be true. Okay, then it's interesting if you think you think one might be true, but you actually prefer the other to be true. So that's an interesting answer. But we're going to say what you believe most likely to be the case. So let's
just clarify something.
Yeah.
Are we allowed to choose any x or y we like, if you think about this? Because there's some x's and y's where it's obvious they're always going to choose x, right? We're not talking about x, sorry.
you can look at this number one. Because you might want to choose this, I can see why you might want to choose this one under some circumstances, this one under other circumstances. If you say, somebody asks you in the morning, what do you like, tea or coffee? You say, well, I don't mind. So I say, I'll have tea. Well, there's kind of no rational deliberation, it's just I pick something at random. So I'm probably thinking about something where there are good reasons for choosing both, but for one reason I choose one over the other. So rather than something which is totally... doesn't matter, and make a kind of random decision where when somebody asks why we made that decision, we say, well, we don't know. And I'm not kind of thinking of those cases. Does that kind of help? Anyway, so who, share a little poll? Who wants to agree with this one, the lift your spontaneity? Yeah, so you always do the same thing. And who wants to say they have retained the ability to do either?
It's
1.5. Yeah, so who wants to kind of say why they want to choose one or the other, or why they think it's a bad question?
Third one.
Yeah, what's the third one?
Because I think if this situation is exactly the same every time, as you say, the two are the equivalent. You cannot choose between them because you will be making a choice, but it'll always be the same choice because the circumstances are identical.
Yes.
Therefore, there is no distinction between the two.
Why? So I'm not sure. I see, why is there no distinction between the two?
Because you still have the liberty to choose, but because the circumstances are the same, you'll want to choose.
So in this one they mean you still have...
You still have a choice, but you will naturally choose the person.
Okay. The way it's often taken is that not only you have the ability to choose, but if it was repeated a certain number of times, you would make different choices.
But you wouldn't if the circumstances were identical.
Oh, I know, then you're, I think you're agreeing with that one then.
Yeah. Not necessarily, then you're claiming that quantum mechanics plays no.
So what the kind of question is asking is, could freedom be compatible with determinism in the end? So the question is, if the world is indeterminate, well, what's that? Let's say we assume that the world is determinate for the moment, as well.
I'll say I want Schrödinger's cat to be alive when I open the box, but I think we're actually number one.
So you prefer number two, but you think we're number one?
Yeah.
But no, why would you prefer number two?
Well, because I want Schrödinger's cat to be alive when I open the box.
I just want to have the choice, but the scientists seem to be suggesting that you see this as the essence of choice, but why that you don't have that choice. Whereas some people want to say this would say actually the essence of choice is that my mind is in this previous state of the universe. It's my mind that wants to do this, and if that's the same, then I'm going to do the same thing.
Well, the way I look at it is, I want to accept, I'm a reasonable person, anything that you've got, I want a reasonable choice, I can testify.
Yeah.
If I can testify the circumstances are exactly the same, and my brain is exactly the same, I'd make exactly the same decision because I want to testify the same way.
Yeah.
If it was completely random, I'd say it's not my choice.
Yeah. Okay.
It's random.
Yeah. So you're kind of siding with saying, actually, I want to have my choice attributable, that's more important to me than having kind of freedom from, total kind of freedom from the past. Yeah.
Does it not also depend on the amount of time which has elapsed between the question being answered? If, of course, we obviously don't live, well, at least I believe, in a Newtonian universe, and surely if quantum mechanics does play a part, just as much as...
So this is a totally hypothetical question, because you can't... This experiment can't ever be done, because you can't repeat the whole. So it's kind of exactly. So there's a. Then you could say, well, what's why is this important question important or not? Or is it important? I think. Yeah, and I think it's worth saying is, should we is determinism the enemy of freedom? That's kind of the real question to start asking. And some people would think, yeah, determinism is the enemy, and that then influences how they think about their theology, because they want to have indeterminacy to give freedom. Whereas others would say, actually, the determinism isn't the problem.
You could be determined to have free will.
Depending on how, yeah, exactly. But then it depends on how you define free will. That's the kind. See. Anyway. Work out your answer.
You could have the free will to be determined.
Certainly. Anyway. So Donald Mackay, he's neuroscientist, Scottish neuroscientist, who was a professor at Keele, and he's very influential in the kind of Christians in Science movement in the 60s, 70s and 80s. So he died in 1986. But he was a good Scottish Calvinist, and he was a definite proponent of this first idea, this liberty of spontaneity, that you choose the same thing with the universe was repeated, and he had this kind of dual aspect view of the mind. So there are a number of ways he starts to think about. One of the things he is about the mind-brain problem. So he eschews any idea of causation between levels. So you have this level, the mind and the brain, he would see them running along in parallel and how they work reflected each other. But there wasn't some kind of, to get the bottom to do its work, the top didn't have to give it a kick somehow, a magical kick. He would see them as kind of both working together. And so, yeah. So in saying this, he would say, the former aspect of evil working is determined by our conscious thinking, evaluating, deciding, even while at the physiological level, physical causality might reign undisturbed. So you might have this kind of physical determinism, but he wouldn't see that as incompatible with our mind working, because the structure of the mind is such that the mind did the bidding of the brain did the bidding of the mind. And then thinking about freedom, he sees, insofar as quantum events disrupted the normal cause and effect relationship between the physical correlates of my rational deliberation, such events might be held to diminish rather than enhance my responsibility for the outcome. So he actually kind of prefers some kind of determinism acting in the kind of level of the mind, because he thinks chance events have been, they could all, in his view, only kind of obscure that freedom, because he wants his mind to be determining what's going on, and the brain, what's going on in the brain, is just a reflection of what's going on in the mind, and so he doesn't see any kind of determinism as a problem for us being able to choose. So this was kind of consistent with his theological position. He was a kind of Calvinist. He saw God as author of all that is, and that he did believe that God could know what we do, but yet we could be free. So he wouldn't have any kind of problem with this kind of summary of how sovereignty and human freedom would interact. So the second kind of case study is a guy called John Polkinghorne. He's probably well known to quite a lot of you. So he was a professor of mathematical physics in Cambridge, and then he kind of finished that early and then became a vicar. And he wrote lots, and he still talks lots about the interaction of science and faith. And has probably been the most kind of influential person in that area in the UK for the last 20 years. But when thinking about these questions, again, he would think about, have this kind of view of the mind and body. There is only one stuff, but they have different aspects. But we would see that this kind of liberty and difference, this ability to have freedom from the past, isn't part of the essence of freedom, that freedom can't be compatible with the determinism. It has to have this indeterminacy. So he kind of illustrates some of these ideas and how it fleshes out into his kind of theology. He says, so this is quite an interesting thing. Our capacity to discern truth requires human rational judgment to join an autonomous validity which would be negated if it were the byproduct of mere physical necessity. So it goes beyond thinking about just whether necessity is compatible with our freedom, but he's saying any kind of necessity is incompatible with our ability to evaluate whether things are true or not. So would go further than, yeah. But he would say a similar thing about freedom, that, that indeterminacy from the past is mere physical necessity. He would see it as being incompatible with freedom, human freedom. So he wants to say about chance events that they are generally indeterminate, that they are indeterminate to God's will. And when he thinks about this kind of dual aspect monism, he would want to say the complementarity of mind and matter lies some radical indefiniteness present in the structure of the basic stuff.
He's saying God's not omnipotent.
That's not caricaturing what he would say. So he would say God, when we come to that, he would say God has self-limited himself. So he's chosen to give, the world freedom, and for him freedom means actually saying, giving over what happens to the world and not to him. So he has a kind of different view of how these levels interact. For him it's important that the top can interact with the bottom. So this is kind of a difficult thing to understand. What he's trying to say is that for these two levels to interact with each other and the top to cause something happen at the bottom, there must be some kind of process by which the top can input some information down to the bottom and cause it to go one way rather than the other way. So it's kind of a different view of how he sees these two levels working. But going on to theology, he says, chance and necessity are reflections of the twin gifts of freedom and reliability bestowed on the creation by the one who's both loving and faithful. So we see actually that God has self-limited himself, that he doesn't allow these events to be truly free, truly chance events which are undetermined by God, and to be a gift of freedom. So he's really associating chance kind of with freedom and necessity, natural law, with kind of reliability. And this kind of stems from his belief, his kind of views about how freedom is entwined with determinacy. And so I would say creation is both being and becoming, and the being is a reflection of chance, in some sense. So God is then self-limited in his knowledge, self-limited in his power, because he's given over to creation a freedom to follow its own course, independent of him. But then you have the question of how then does God interact with the world if he's given over freedom to the world, and he said given control over the world of what happens to that world. So he has to have, in some sense, another mechanism for restoring control. And again, he would kind of think about these chaotic systems. So these systems where you have a real sensitivity to the initial conditions, what happens? If you can input some little bit of information to make it go one way rather than the other way, this is how then God restores some aspect of control over the world, you see. You see God as a kind of euphemism, a kind of metaphor like to use, God as the grand master of cosmic chess, responding to but never baffled by the moves of the creaturely opponent, and so sure to deliver eventual checkmate as the game unfolds. So you see that God is in the end can achieve the ends he wants, even though he's given freedom over to creation by because he's the grandmaster of cosmic chess. I'm not quite sure how he sees the details of that working out, but he sees that actually God has still got enough control in some way to then okay. So that's what kind of where I wanted to get to. But what I'm trying to show is actually I don't think we have to have anything to fear for our theology from the scientific description of the world and how that might influence our views of God providence. But I think that is true, that actually these kind of basic questions about how the mind works, what is the essence of freedom, will have an influence on how we think about God acting in the world. And by thinking about this question, I want to kind of show that I think our natural kind of tendency is to say that, to think of determinism as the enemy, And I would want to kind of suggest that perhaps that's really not what the kind of enemy of freedom, the essence of freedom. I would be more. I think I'm more happy with this. Not totally happy with this. That we don't need necessarily, if we don't want to, sort of throw out particular views of God, more traditional views of God, because we feel that there's kind of philosophical need. I'm not sure that's case is compelling. So that's all I want to say. Thank you for your think about that. And these kind of questions could be quite complex, and I've battled minds for thousands of years, and I don't think we're not going to answer them tonight, but hopefully by thinking about them might actually, it's not kind of totally an idle academic task, but it's one that is relevant to how we think about the world. So thank you for your attention.
About what we thought was right. And we actually plumped quite firmly down on Donald Mackay's side with the sort of determinism not being incompatible with the provenance. And it's quite a strong argument, isn't there? So I guess what John's saying now is that he doesn't want to kind of rubbish John Hoppenholm out of hand as we did. So if you want to see, you know, our personal view of it, which is not necessarily the right one, then do by all means take one of these papers. Obviously you've got time now to talk about it. So I've asked Andrew Halstrap to chair. Please have your questions and off you go.
So does anyone want to start the ball rolling, or are you going to leave? Go on, John, go straight off.
Well, with number one, we don't always do what we want to do. Sometimes we do what we don't want to do because it's inconvenient or painful or nasty to us, but we think we ought to do it.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to take into account. Anyway, I don't like number one.
Yeah, I think the way it's phrased, yeah, perhaps the want was in the kind of more general sense, yeah, of what you're choosing, what you're deciding is the right thing, or what you could be the right thing, or could be decided even though it's the wrong thing, but because you're wanting to decide that for some reason.
But one other comment. I understand if you do brain scans and things, you can tell before somebody does something what they're going to do.
Yeah, so
So that would support number one.
So, I'm not an expert in the neuroscience kind of area. Yeah. I know how these kind of results are interpreted is not straightforward.
Right. Okay.
But I can't really comment on that because I don't know enough about. Yeah.
But what you're saying is that there are numerous inputs coming into our brain, and the scan will detect those. What makes us decide the action that we take as a result of all those inputs? And that's what free will is.
Yes, but I understand that you're not conscious of what you're going to do, and the observer can write down, you know, you're going to pick up your left hand and move the object. You can say that before you're conscious of it, and yet you would decide that in the end.
I think he says, the time which you feel conscious of having made that decision can sometimes be later than the...
But can you make
that's difficult because the kind of difficult interpretation is the consciousness kind of view of when it decided to do something.
You may have made that choice effectively years ago in the previous experience, giving you the free choice.
Yes.
Question there?
Yeah, I'm not easy about the resurrection being described as a miracle. In fact, in many ways, I see it as a reclamation of the natural order, and what we're in at the moment is the fallenness of the natural order. And I think, again, the term of miracle is one of these sort of terms that's bandied about very unhappily, in my view, because this idea that a miracle is somehow outside of nature, to my mind, is nonsense. It cannot be other than inside of nature. And again, also, this whole concept of physical laws. I mean, there are observed regularities. Now, an observed regularity is different from the law. Because the sun has risen every day for however many tens of thousands or millions of years, doesn't of itself indicate that it will rise tomorrow. And likewise cause and effect, you can have things that are sequential, but the causality is very often within our own minds. We either want to believe it's causal, or we do believe that it's causal, but that there can just be sequential events that don't go any further. So I certainly want to reclaim the resurrection from being a miracle. I want to reclaim miracles from the sort of sun or mirror view of it, and I want to get into sort of observe regularities rather than laws, and I want to escape from cause and effect, at least in the sense that it's generally meant. Any comments?
Yeah, so in terms of miracles, yeah, I think when something a miracle, when something just God's providential action, so I think the kind of dividing line is totally arbitrary in some sense, but this is kind of yeah, it is a label that's used, and I was kind of responding to that. So, I think I would want to say that a resurrection is a miracle, and other things are a miracle. But how you draw the line, and as I'm saying, it's not. I don't see it to give something label a miracle. It's not saying about anything about from my point of view about necessity of breaking of physical law or observed regularities. I don't have a problem with the calling things laws. Yeah, we know that what we are effectively saying is they are observed regularities that help us to understand how the world works, and that they're reliable and that and trustworthy. When we look at things again and again, we see that same regularity, that same law.
Is a miracle purely defined by its rarity factor?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to give a definition of a miracle. What has to be big enough or spectacular enough to be a miracle and not to be something else? I think that's kind of arbitrary in some sense. Yeah.
Rebecca, I saw first, and we got a couple over here, one over there. So.
You quoted Proverbs 16:5, and a man who is wise plans his steps, but God maps his course.
Yeah.
So how does
that fit in with
choice number one?
The spontaneity
and the choice that you can make.
So,
God's plans, your
course. Yeah, so Donald Mackay wouldn't have any problem with that, whereas a statement like that to John Polkinghorne, he'd feel very, very uncomfortable with it. Because if you feel that a liberty of spontaneity is okay, then it is compatible with some kind of determinism, being it physical determinism or some kind of theological determinism. So
isn't it saying that actually God must take away your complete liberty?
Well, you could still be, that decision could still reflect your choice and what you wanted to do. But there, if you have believe in some kind of theological determinism lying behind that, then you are saying there's some givenness to you from God, yeah. And that might, so that might be something you're comfortable with or something you're uncomfortable with. But
do you think there's an element here, we think in terms of time, and God's vision of it is outside of time. So that as far as we're concerned, we're making a free decision. If God's outside of time, he'll know the decision we've made, and therefore he's incorporated that into his scheme of things.
So yeah, when people think about some kind of theological determinism, you can have different kind of views of that. You can have an idea of some like to ameliorate that by saying that God has foreknowledge of not what we do, but not determine what we do. So yeah, there's kind of these different kind of views on this kind of theology. I'm not sure I want to get into that kind of debate, but yeah,
So I'm going to go a bit, because there's a couple of questions here, then I'll come over here. So you're on the end there first.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what was
was said before about the eagle serving the sun, you know, rising every morning. And I think that we do talk about scientific laws, but as far as I can see, these laws are not set even for men. In fact, there are scientific revolutions, and you know, before the Copernican revolutions, we had a certain set of laws. Before Einstein or before Newton, we had a certain set of laws, and then we changed them. And, well, because we had new so-called laws that fitted the data better, I guess. So I think I personally find it quite helpful to kind of remind myself when we look at science that it's always a theory and it's always possible to improve it. And if not, I personally see that as our limited ability to, let's say, grasp the sort of final laws, if you like.
No, I agree that we as scientists, you need to have humility in the sense of we know we're not capturing everything in when we describe things. But on the other hand, I think certain theories work so well that it'd be a big surprise to me if they were kind of superseded. It might be that in certain limits, extreme limits, they might not hold, but for the basic reality, say the quantum mechanics, then I'm not holding my breath that something will come along and say, actually, quantum mechanics might say, when you unify forces in your summer ground, I'm not into that kind of stuff, but you might have to change things then. But for everyday life, quantum mechanics, for example, is remarkably reliable. It's a brilliant theory, and I'm happy calling it a law, but you have to be humble saying, well, we might be wrong, but I'd be kind of very surprised.
I think the apple is always going to fall down, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cool. I think you had a question there, Greg.
Just a comment. I heard it said that you could look at it like the Bible way, maybe, that God's kind of on moment by moment keeping creation going. And so, you know, those kind of what we call laws is God speaking moment by moment of how things work. And a miracle is just God saying something different. He's not actually breaking anything. He's just saying something slightly different.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfectly half the way I think about it.
So, you know, it says like all things are created through Christ or God speaks in that sort of way. Yeah. And as you say, on the whole, he's consistent. Mm. But the fact that on the odd occasion, for a reason, he might say something different.
Exactly, yeah. I think that what I was trying to stress in the first thing, that I don't think scientific law or physical law is really a constraint to God. It might be a reflection of how the world usually works and how he's created it, but I don't think that we should then use that as then a constraint on our theology and saying God
laws,
must act.
Our laws are a reflection on how consistent he is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and to me, he always has to be. That's the same way.
Yeah, I totally agree.
There was one there, one there, one there, one there. Right. In that order.
Going back to the nature of miracle, I'm afraid. I mean, what's Polkinghorne's view on foreknowledge? I mean, for example, if you've got a chaotic but classical world, then, for instance, to have the storm that Jesus calms, God can be the butterfly that flaps its wings in Belize 3 months earlier. But if you incorporate any degree of, if you like, uncertainty built in at the foundations, like quantum mechanics, as I said, I could go down to the lab, prepare a photon, and I can't tell you in advance which outlet of the polarizer is going to come out of. How does Polkinghorne mix in the predestination? Does he go for chaotic and quantum indeterminism, or is he more
He does like this idea of these chaotic systems being able to input information into them, but I'm less clear how he envisages the sort of chaotic regime interacting with the quantum regime, and whether, So some people sort of have done a kind of similar thing, but like to see God determining the kind of quantum events to move things one way or the other. But his kind of preferred kind of model of thinking about it is in terms of some input of information, but not energy, into these chaotic systems. But there's difficulty when you're that chaotic system is grappling with the quantum world.
I think the word mystery comes to mind.
I was going to say, since everybody else is having comments, I think I ought to be allowed one. Even though this sort of stuff is only fruitful if it leads you to more godly living and making the world a better place.
Yeah.
Well,
that's wonderful.
There was
a hand up here.
Oh, was it? Sorry, I missed you. Yeah, all right. Well, very good. Thank you.
We're not happy on philosophical grounds with this dual aspect monism.
Okay.
I think it's an attempt to try and find middle ground between dualism and materialism, which actually doesn't hold water. I mean, is one saying that mind in itself and in principle is an aspect of an organic being? And so what about the divine mind? Or is it just you're saying that our minds de facto we think are the same, some aspect of our brains? In other words, is this an in principle thing that mind must be the same as one way of describing an organic reality, or is this just a contingent and empirical statement?
Yeah. So a couple of things. I think the way this is kind of traditionally interpreted, man was made in the image of God and had the same abilities as God to make decisions, and that was coming from some, as God is not material, then we might have this non-material stuff which is able to do, and then that's kind of could be a reasonable position. I think the kind of a lot of scientists want to say that because they see it hard to see the room for that kind of stuff in interacting with the brain. They see the brain is actually so important for how the mind functions that they're reluctant to postulate something else which is outside of brain.
Yeah, it seems to me really just a try, because people are afraid of going down to number three materialism, they're trying to cook up this sort of middle position.
Well,
I don't think there's room for middle position.
Well, no, that's where I disagree. So I definitely think I'm happy with the fact that, well, the idea that you can have a system which can have high levels and which where those high levels have real determining ability. I'm happy with that. I think we see it on the computer, and that comes from just the matter is structured. So you have, of course, the computer is a conscious, and you say how can something material give rise to something which is not only has high levels, which are the best way to think about what's happening in that system, but have things like consciousness. Of course, that's a total mystery. I don't sort of deny the possibility of that kind of thing, but there's more kind of a lot of scientists want to be at this from some kind of empirical position rather than because it has to be this way. But for them, it looks as though it's that way. I think that's where.
Any approximate sort of numbers for scientists who aren't materialists?
Who would want to be a kind of classical dualist? I'm not sure.
I doubt there was hardly any scientists.
Yeah, so there was one famous person who used to, a guy called John Eccles, who had these kind of ideas how.
I was asking
for statistics. Yeah, I have no idea. But there are examples, but they're rare.
I'd say it'd be in the 90%, high 90% would be materialist, obviously.
Yeah.
Did you want? We've had questions already.
The whole talk you're giving, you're saying you go with the Mackay position and not the Hobbes.
Well, that's probably
clarification on. Does that mean still that you? Does that still put you in a position of that God is not omnipotent and not visible?
Mackay would be very happy with this kind of classical, this kind of perhaps more traditional statement of God being absolute sovereign. Yeah, so he wouldn't have a. He wouldn't have any problem with that.
So there's no sense limitation. No,
Mackay would say, well, he would see freedom as being compatible with some kind of theological determinism in some sense. And if you're saying that God is absolutely sovereign, but that we're responsible, you're saying that these both are true at the same time, and there is that God must, in some sense, be behind our actions. I think it's hard to have that, to sign up for both of them without believing in some kind of theological kind of determinism or foreknowledge or, yeah.
Does he talk about the I story and the God story?
Yeah, he talks about the I story and the brain story.
Yeah.
Putting possibly that as well. Yeah.
He needs to have a chat with Stephen Pinker.
Yeah.
There was one at the back there. Yeah.
I can't remember what the question was. Interesting. If I meet secular people and we get on to this discussion about free will and determinism, I tend to want to bat the ball back into their half of the table and say something that along these lines, Christian compatibilism offers me hope, but they haven't got any hope. Mm. Is that a fair argument? If not, should I scrap it? Or can I improve on it?
Put me on the spot there. Yeah, well, I think it's important that sort of different arguments are philosophically consistent, I think. But I, as I said, I don't necessarily have... One of the kind of points I was trying to, as I said, probably a bit more categorical in what we said when I was a graduate student than what I'm saying now. And want to kind of give you, rather than trying to tell you why you should think about this. But I, what I kind of try to emphasise that we shouldn't rule out the, immediately that determinism and free will are, say determinism and free will are automatically incompatible, and that automatically says we must have a certain view of God. I'm saying, I'm not sure the philosophy of it justifies that kind of step, and that we need to be more careful in thinking about, and perhaps more open when we think about how freedom and determinism interact. And so, I don't think it's philosophically inconsistent to think. I don't think it's philosophically inconsistent to hold some kind of position like this. And if you do, then you say actually. The reason I believe is not, it's for a whole host of reasons, and that's what you're trying to say. And of course, a lot of this talk was saying, actually, we look at chance events, it depends what our presuppositions are. And then you say, why is my presupposition that God exists? And that's for a whole host of reasons. And and it can be on a, I think there's lots of room for kind of personal reasons why you think God exists, rather than just kind of philosophical reasons, which is kind of what you're suggesting.
I mean, I think what you may be saying, the way that I feel when I talk to people is that they're just saying chance and nothing but chance, which is a philosophy of hopelessness, really.
Yes.
I'm just the result of a chemical cauldron in my brain that's randomly banging in and brings up a certain behaviour pattern. Whereas I think as Christians we do see something of the divine interacting with that process and giving it purpose. We may not understand the detail, but there is an element there that makes it more than just chance, but chance processes are still going on. If you go back to your Brownian motion, I mean, one of the things that I often think of is that if you have a Brownian motion, you can still give a whole load of particles direction. They're still random, but they're given direction. And in a sense, is that a way that we can look at God interacting with us in our brain? That there's still the chemistry and so on going on, but there's another input which we don't fully understand, which is the divine. I don't know, I mean, that's how I tend to look at it. But there was a question here.
Yeah. If my decisions are caused by theological determinism and a logical conclusion from the previous events of the first option, how then can we be held responsible for our actions?
No, that's a difficult question, yeah, exactly. I didn't really get on to theological, I concentrated on physical determinism rather than theological determinism, partly because of those kind of difficult questions.
You haven't escaped, have you?
No, I haven't escaped. So it is a difficult question, and I think we've got to recognise there's a certain givenness to ourselves, that we are who we are, not just because we choose who we are. So even if you kind of initiate, you're happy with this on a physical level, and you say, well, I'm happy that I determined this event because I chose it, and my mind chose it, and that's me choosing that. But then you map those kind of chain of physical events which involved you, and you get back to before there was you, and you were just an embryo in your mother's womb. So where does this... where does this I come from that is making those decisions? And that's kind of a difficult question. Who determines who I am? And I think that's difficult for either of them. And yeah, so can is it philosophically reasonable to say actually God can somehow map out who we are, but then we're still free?
But you could turn the question back on yourself and say, actually, do you not experience free will? I mean, do you actually? I think most people who make the argument can't have free will actually know perfectly well they do.
Yeah.
So again, there's a mystery. I mean, we are aware, and yet we don't understand. But there's Martha, you were next, and then there's one on the other side there.
I think one of the problems with this discussion is that we're making a sort of one of the classic mistakes is that we're inheriting another dualism here, because we're ignoring completely the spiritual side of life and of God. You can sort of go to the very Greek approach and just looking very much at our physical bodies and our minds, rather than actually how God, like in spirit, interacts with us. And I think if you look at Paul's letters in terms of the battle that's going on in the principalities and powers, the overall fight of good against evil, then you might begin to have a little more sympathy with Baltimore's view that there's another dimension going on here where God is involved in a battle and a struggle. We know the outcome is victory, but there's no clear path to that. But how does that kind of
There's you could have the mind body problem, the spirit body problem, if you like, and you could have take different positions on the spirit body problem and the mind body problem. I'm not thinking as my spirit being some kind of separate stuff, like my mind being some kind of separate stuff which operates in a different kind of reality, and then it interacts with this physical reality. I see my kind of spirit embodied in who I am here in this physical reality.
Do you still have a soul? Do you still have a soul then?
I'm comfortable with my soul not being some separate stuff. It's embodded in who I am, and that if I'm re-embodied later by God, that God can do that re-embodying.
I know rat wouldn't, you'd be a scientist who would say a rat wouldn't, but you would.
Well, I think any re-embodiment is to do with God, not with to do with,
You might say a rat can have soul.
I think that's
tough. So I'm going to take the round last question forward. There's one behind there.
Hi, I don't know if this helps, going back to how responsible if what we're doing determines. I don't know if this helps. For example, you correct me if I get this wrong. David sinned when he did a census, and it says that that God sent the devil or demon to cause him to sin to do that census, so he would sin so God could ultimately bring judgment on Israel. And that was an event that was caused ultimately by God, and so you could say it's determined. Then David goes later on to say, "I have grievously sinned." So he sort of recognised how he was still held responsible for that act. So it was kind of the sense that God might have been standing behind it and was in control of it, but not in the same, but stood behind it in a way that man is still held completely responsible for their actions. I don't know.
So yeah, I think kind of going back to this question. So you say, well, can freedom be compatible with theological determinism? But does theological indeterminism make us more free?
I think we probably want to finish this.
I've got to take on. Railway station.
Well, I've seen another two questions. One that's up there and one here, and then we might call it a day because I think you're getting pretty exhausted.
Just a comment on the indifference. Although this is a sort of mental spinning the coin.
Yeah.
If you spin a coin physically, there are certain laws which determine, although we may not be able to find it very accurately, determine which way that coin is going down. Now, when we make an indifferent decision, there are laws going on in our brain which we don't know about, but which God knows about. And he knew before eternity which way that was going to come. So in that way, it's determined.
Yeah, you obviously.
And the other thing I'd like to make a comment on is one incident in Jesus' life where a silver coin sort of trickling down through the water, and they had to pay their taxes. And a fish swallowed this coin, and Jesus says, "Go on, pick up the net, and go and get your net, catch this fish." So obviously there was a certain amount of determinism going on there with random events. So I don't think we should underestimate the foreknowledge of God.
Okay.
Thank you. Reference was made just now to the time when we were embryos in the womb. Let's project our imagination further back still, when we were simply just a fertilized egg. Now, what determines, presumably, the sort of person we are is determined then. How are we going to grow? What shape we're going to have? And what our characteristics will be? How does that happen now with the laws of chaos apply?
Do they apply? One of the things that's kind of slightly arbitrary about this thing is that in the biological world, it's just you've got stochasticity everywhere, the way that the biology works. If you're talking about what determines you in this kind of line of causality, of course, what's coming into that causality is the environment around you, what's happening in that. So it's not just your genes, or whatever. Even if you see yourself as some sense being determined from this kind of line of causality, that they're all lines of causality impinging on you all the time.
And even one of the things that we learnt recently in science is that even identical twins who have the same genetic makeup, the whole process of epigenetics, things change later in life.
Yes.
So they won't actually turn out identical. They'll have a lot of similarities, but they won't be identical, even though they're genetically identical when they're fertilized. So there's a lot of things we don't understand. I think we should call it a day. Jonathan, you've certainly stretched our mind. I don't think any of us have gone away with the answer. If we had, I think I'd be worried.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of food for thought, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
The new program hasn't been produced yet, but if people can give me their name and email address, I'll make sure the secretary circulates the new program to them.
Okay, well, you can either come up to Chris afterwards, but I mean, they do kind of more theological things rather than scientific things. But I'm very happy to circulate another email with Chris's email on it, so you can get into contact with him. And just to remind you, there's a parish magazine with the article by Father Boyle on next talk, Cynthia, 19th November. See you here.
Well, I could mention actually Bristol School of Christian Studies. I didn't bring the details, and I can't remember the exact date.
13th of October.
Bishop Lee Rayfield, who was an immunologist, now a bishop, but he serves on the government genetics or something or other advisory board. He's going to be doing something on issues associated with life, new life, and genetics. And I can't remember the exact title. I'm sure you'll hear about it.
The title is Being Human.
Thank you. So you're better informed than I am. I'm only chairman.
Yes. We found out about the kind of, because I thought we'd have a genetics talk, and then Andy said that they were having their genetics talk. But I think they're sufficiently different, and they're also opposite ends of the term, that you'll be fulfilled by getting to both of them. So, thank you very much.
Sorry,
for
what was the when and where on that one?
It's the Bishop School of Christian Studies.
I'll circulate it. I'll circulate it in the email. I'll email around. Okay? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.